From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. A pleasure as always.
Don, pleasure is all mine.
So, I understand you're preparing a series on the Western imperial attack on BRICS, and the first installment's out this week, starting with the B in BRICS, Brazil. You want to give us a little preview?
Yeah, exactly. So I have a series that will be coming out through Mint Press News. Basically what I'm doing is I'm trying to examine and provide analytical context for what I consider to be a coordinated assault on the BRICS. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, probably the most prominent and perhaps most significant of the non-Western political and economic groupings that have emerged in the last decade or so. And it's interesting because, Don, you and I and, you know, many others have been talking a lot about it, all of the various multilateral institutions, be they BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the One Belt, One Road, all of these various initiatives, which I guess fall under this broad umbrella of non-hegemonic, non-Western institutions. And, you know, we've been talking so much about them and their emergence, but one of the things that I've always mentioned or, you know, cautioned people about is not to get too triumphal about all of these things, because there is no doubt that the empire, you know, for without making a Star Wars reference,
we'll
that the empire
back.
Will strike
That's
back,
right.
You know, and the empire is striking back.
That's
and
right.
It's striking back in many ways. And this first installment of the series is going to focus on what's happening in Brazil, because what's happening in Brazil right now, the mainstream media reports as, you know, simply a protest movement with millions coming out in the streets demanding the resignation and or impeachment and or overthrow of the democratically elected government led by Dilma Rousseff and the Workers Party. The media presents this as merely a, you know, an attempt to address issues of corruption stemming from this scandal involving the quasi-state-owned Petrobras oil company in Brazil. And the reality is that corruption is actually only the superficial pretext for what I consider to be a coordinated campaign of what could be called a soft coup, which is what a lot of people in Brazil are calling it, a destabilization, a non-color, color revolution, however you want to describe it. But the reality is that that's what's happening, and it is very sinister forces inside of Brazil and very sinister forces internationally that are coordinating this and that are driving this movement to overthrow the government. And when I say the government, it's not simply Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party. This is also her predecessor, Lula da Silva.
And
who
possible
is,
successor, right? He announced it on March 1st that in fact, he confirmed that, I may well be a candidate for president.
Yeah, exactly. And he's actually being brought back in by Rousseff. Now, some are saying it's to avoid prosecution. And obviously, there's some political positioning and jockeying going on there. But this is also the way that the left in Brazil, those that are in power, the Workers' Party, is essentially presenting a united front against this destabilization campaign. Now,
before we go any further, let me go back into something that you said first, because as far as the opposition forces on the ground there that are driving this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to.
Yeah, they've had to change the face of it because, in fact, the primary mover up until very recently was found to have Swiss bank accounts and to be waist deep in corruption where they're alleging that Rousseff and or Lula had maybe a couple of drops of water on their foreheads.
Yeah, and actually what you're getting at, and you're totally right, there's two separate elements here. On the one hand, you have a governmental push against Rousseff and the Workers' Party from, like, prosecutors, right? From, I guess, what we might call, you know, district attorneys or something like that. You know, these prosecutors inside the government who are also very much embroiled in their own corruption scandal. Right. But at the same time, we also need to focus on the forces that are in the streets, because those forces are actually directly connected to reactionary right-wing finance capital inside of Brazil and in the U.S. So just a couple of examples. Two of the major, let's call them opposition groups or whatever, that are organizing and mobilizing these demonstrations. One of them is called the Free Brazil Movement, or MBL, and another is called Students for Liberty, or EPL. Both of these organizations have direct connections to none other than, drumroll, Koch brothers. Okay, they are funded by the Koch brothers, the right-wing, free market, you know, pro-business extremists in the United States, who have, of course, direct connections to a lot of political forces inside the country, including, well, up until very recently, their total dominance of the Republican Party, and of course, internationally as well, as they are connected to major oil investments all over the world, including in Brazil. Right. So the Free Brazil Movement and Students for Liberty, which are connected to the Koch brothers. Now, the individuals who are leading these organizations, one of the ones who's been featured really prominently, he's been interviewed by the Associated Press, by all the major media, is this kid, 20-year-old activist named Kim Kataguiri. Okay, and Kim Kataguiri is basically, he is being presented as the youth face of this opposition movement. But who exactly is he? Well, he is a right-wing extremist. He is an unabashed worshiper of Milton Friedman and the Austrian School of Economics. He is a, you know, basically he said openly that he wants to change the public perception of the right wing. He said that openly in an interview with The Guardian. I could quote him right here. He says, quote, "We defend free markets, lower taxes, and the privatization of all public companies. In Brazil, the left is still seen as cool by young people. We want to destroy this idea that if you defend free markets, you're an old man who's asking for dictatorship. Unfortunately, we don't have any big sponsors. The government and some sectors of the press say we're financed by rich people. We would have no problem in being financed by rich people." Well, sorry, Kim. My darling little child, you are funded by rich people, and we know exactly who is funding you, including your friends Osterman and Torres and all of the other leaders of this so-called movement, who are all being backed by these forces. Now, I just want to say really quickly, and, you know, Don, I'll let you respond here, but there is a public relations campaign happening here at the very same time as this protest movement is developing, because what you're seeing is this kid, Kim Kataguiri, and some of the other leaders of this so-called movement, they are all making a very clear attempt to distance themselves from the extremely brutal and horrific legacy of right-wing dictatorships in South America and in Brazil in particular, and in Chile, of course. And it's very interesting, because what they're actually doing is they're fronting for the same economic policies, the same economic theories, and in many cases, the same individuals who backed all of those coups, who led the 1973 overthrow in Chile and the installment of Pinochet and the dictatorship. Milton Friedman, all the rest of that, shock therapy, Naomi Klein's written about it, many others have written about it. This is now reemerging. This ugly face is reemerging in Brazil, and that's what this protest movement is really about.
You know, and the there's some interesting public relations aspects to it, because you know, you're talking about basically the rehabilitation of their image.
Yep.
On the one hand, the Koch brothers and many others, of course, love to see, even if left and right wing politicians are indicted over Petrobras, that, well, it's natural. A publicly owned oil company draws corruption. That's the imagery that they want to put out. And this happens in the context of what they're claiming is a right-wing revival, a conservative renewal across Latin America. We're talking about, of course, the National Assembly in Venezuela and Macri in Argentina specifically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, the notion here, what they're trying to put forward is that the Workers' Party and the left, that they are inherently corrupt, that they lied, that they've cheated, that they've stolen, and that they are corrupt when in fact, of course, the history all throughout Latin America and in particular in Brazil, of course, shows that the scale of corruption, the scale of graft that's going on here is actually minuscule in comparison to what happened in previous decades. Now, let's not forget, too, there is a very cynical element to all of this, and that is the exploitation of an economic downturn. You see, a lot of the people who have turned out into the streets are not necessarily the right-wing ideologues. A lot of them are the middle class. A lot of them are even, some of them are working class as well, who have been hit hard by the major drop in commodities prices, obviously That's the right. oil price and some other key economic factors. And it is the exploitation of this economic downturn that is allowing them to ride this wave of discontent. And so this kind of manipulation, it's not, you know, Brazil is not the only place where we've seen it. But this is, I think, really rearing its ugly head, because if you look at the actual numbers, and I cite some of these in my article, which I think should be published on Tuesday of this week, that the rise in discontent, that the rise of the protest movement directly coincides with the drop in oil prices. It directly coincides with the downturn in all of these economic factors. So you can see what's happening here. The right wing in Brazil has mobilized its forces for a significant push against the government, primarily because they want to exploit the economic crisis. Moreover, we should keep in mind, too, that a lot of the same forces that are driving this opposition movement are the ones who are driving the movements all over Latin America.
And, you know, you have seen some pushback already. I mean, as you mentioned, I don't remember the terminology you used, but it's been a slow rolling coup underway for a good 2 years at least. And Rousseff has recently started pushing back. First, she replaced the finance minister. She had basically a free marketeer as a finance minister, as an attempt to compromise with the right. And she replaced that person with a leftist, certainly, and perhaps more. And now bringing Lula into the government as a sort of super prime minister, I guess that's how they've been characterizing it. In addition to that, they've been mobilizing the right's not the only people on the street. The left have been out in the street as well. They've been mobilizing their base.
Yeah, exactly. Opportunistically, of course, and we've seen this in other places as well. Certainly, nobody's suggesting that, you know, the Workers' Party is without any problems. There are problems, and those problems are probably deeply rooted, and there are institutional issues and corruption and all the rest of these things which are present everywhere. But again, we have to keep in mind that when you see this sort of coalescing of forces around a so-called opposition movement, and then you look at each of the major groups that are mobilizing them, and all of them are funded by extreme capitalist, pro-capitalist market-driven forces. I think that tells you a lot. One other one I didn't mention, the organization Vem Pra Rua, which means come to the streets, directly funded by the single most rich, single richest man in Brazil, Jorge Paulo Leman, who Bloomberg and noted that almost nobody in the United States knows who this is. He is one of the number 32 on the Bloomberg Billionaire Index. Guess what he owns? He and his buddies just bought in 2008 Anheuser-Busch. They also own Burger King. They own Heinz Ketchup. They own some of the most well-known brands in U.S. consumer culture. And this is somebody who is funding the forces who claim to be speaking for the Brazilian people. Now, this is a joke.
I'll resist the temptation to ask about the relationship with Kerry's wife's family and this particular person who owns Heinz. But instead, let's among the elite in Brazil, among their billionaire class, whatever, because Brazil has a pretty decent-sized economy. It's one of the largest in Latin America, if not the largest, right? And Argentina, Brazil, I don't remember which is largest. But there's a native bourgeoisie there, and Brazil is in the BRICS grouping, and there is business that's conducted among those. And China, India in particular, both very good markets to be working with. I'm wondering if there isn't any competition going on for winning the allegiance of that class that could perhaps break it up.
Well, there's no doubt that there is. I mean, this is part of the nature of BRICS and part of the reason why the United States sees them as such a threat. It's not just a political threat. There is an economic threat. In many respects, China and India and Russia, probably to a slightly lesser extent, represent an economic counterweight to traditionally, the U.S. Dominant position in Latin America. So, yes, of course. And we've seen China making massive investments throughout Central America. We've seen China, of course, in Venezuela, China in Ecuador. All of the countries where China is most active are not coincidentally all the countries that are seeing destabilization, that are seeing major political upheaval. And all of those are, we see a right wing that is in many respects a proxy of the United States and of Western forces. So yes, indeed, that is the case. But I just want to also point out here that this is not really about corruption either, because we should keep in mind that one of the issues that the right wing in Venezuela, just as in Brazil, has a real problem with, and one of the things that, they'll never say it publicly, but, internally they always lament the fact that these governments, be they the Bolivarian government in Venezuela, the Workers' Party government in Brazil, they represent a widening of representation. In other words, they represent power being placed far more in the hands of working and poor people, rather than that very select group of bourgeois elements, as you mentioned, Don, who had controlled these countries traditionally. They resent more than anything the notion that they are supposed to serve the majority of the population, because that was Lula's base. That is Rousseff's base. It is the majority. This is not to say that the Workers' Party doesn't have issues. This is not to say that there isn't corruption and these, empty stadiums from the World Cup and for the Olympics and all of this stuff, that all of these things are there. But the reality is, and you could see it even in the quotes that you see from people who are in the streets, they identified personally with Lula and with Rousseff and with the Workers' Party. They have a personal connection to them in the same way as the people I spoke to in Caracas when I was in Venezuela had with the Socialist Party and with Chavez and Maduro there. So this same phenomenon is really present all throughout Latin America. And just one other point I want to make, Don, we also noticed, and it flew very much under the radar, when Macri came to power in Argentina recently, one of his campaign promises was that he would finally and ultimately end the dispute with Singer and the right-wing hedge fund operators on Wall Street who had refused to take a haircut and who Cristina Fernandez had basically refused to make a deal with over the course of more than a decade. Well, Macri comes into power, and wouldn't you know it, Singer gets paid off. Singer wins in his standoff with Argentina. Argentina's working class and poor and middle class people, of course, come out the losers, because now billions of dollars from Argentina are going to flow right into the pockets of Wall Street. Yep. That's what this is about. That's right. It is about power and control for Wall Street and reasserting U.S. and finance capital's hegemony in Latin America. Brazil is in many ways the front line.
Yeah, and in some ways, it resembles the period immediately after World War II, in that, China could throw Brazil this, for example, just to give people an idea of scale. They have been discussing, proposing, and working on developing a plan for construction by China of a transcontinental railroad across South America, which would feed into Brazil to go to the West Coast near Brazil and Ecuador in that area. And China could say, you know what, we're going to build this, finance it ourselves, and then use the revenues that we're going to be paying to transport the materials back out to the Pacific to pay, you know, to amortize it. So in other words, you guys don't have to write a single check, and we'll build it, and you will now have this subsidized railroad across the continent. That's the scale that they can offer. So in that context, China is really a player at the negotiating table with the bourgeoisie inside of Brazil, meaning that you actually have multipolarity, multi-block political processes going on inside of these countries. That's what was happening in Europe in 1945, and it hasn't really been true since.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And again, I mean, we can look at tangible examples of that. Look at what China has been able to do in securing the deals for the Grand Canal in Nicaragua. I mean, this is something that for the Chinese, they're willing to fund it. They're willing to allow Nicaragua to benefit from it significantly, because in the long run, it pays off exponentially for China if they have an alternate route to the Panama Canal, if they have a quick and easy shipping route for Chinese goods entering into the Western Hemisphere. So, and just as with a potential transcontinental railroad in South America, this, of course, as you noted, presents major opportunities for the elites in South America. Right. So in many respects, you have basically a competition for influence among the landed, you know, aristocracy, to, for lack of a better term, you know, the bourgeois elements inside of Latin America. And that's why the United States and its, you know, proxies are working so hard to undermine all of these things. In Venezuela, for instance, when you're riding around in Caracas, you see all of the new public transportation buses. All of those are the direct products of a partnership with China. You see increasingly new cars on the road, partnership with China. You see a lot of the very tangible evidence of these relations, and increasingly in various parts of Latin America, you're seeing a major pushback by the West, and in particular the United States, which still sees Latin America as quote-unquote its backyard. And at the same time, you're seeing the United States exploiting and elements inside the United States exploiting this major economic downturn. And it's not just in Brazil. I mean, if you look even at Bolivia, which is heralded as a major economic success story in the midst of this economic downturn, Bolivia is still hurting significantly from some of these drops in prices in gas and in mineral extraction and all of these other things. So there are a lot of economic factors at play here, and I think that is to a large extent what is being seized upon by the right wing.
Now, exactly along that line, the difference in what is offered by the two competing blocs to the people of Latin America, particularly people of South America, and the elites, including the elites, is either the United States regains its position there and you get more neoliberal capitalism, which of course carries with it, ultimately, impoverishment and the need for a dictator to impose. China has its political strategy in terms of foreign policy is we deal with whoever's in power there. We don't want to play politics inside your country. That's for you guys to do. And economically, we want you to prosper. We want your economy to grow because we want rich customers.
Yeah, this is the the sort of the product of China's win-win economic partnership strategy. That basically what they want is they want to set up trade agreements and investment scenarios in which both sides prosper because it benefits China in the long run. China does not want to see any political instability. China needs stability, and for those people on the left who want to say that this just shows that China's capitalist. Well, yes, in a sense, because what China's looking for is not to dictate political terms. China doesn't want to talk about human rights. It doesn't want to talk about democracy. It doesn't want to talk about all of the pretexts that the United States uses to exert its hegemony and control. Rather, China wants to be able to do business in order to benefit itself and to benefit its partners. And we see that all over in Africa, for instance, where China is really heralded as a major alternative to the West. And, you know, some people like to say, well, this is just Chinese imperialism. Well, that's nonsense, because that, A, doesn't really understand the very concept of imperialism as defined by many theorists, including Lenin. B, that doesn't really actually account for the simple fact that, hey, those countries know best what's good for those countries. And oftentimes, that's why China has, I think, exceeded the United States as being a major trading partner. And while I have an article coming out on Brazil this week, next week, I'll have a piece coming out on South Africa, where we're seeing something very similar happening. And South Africa, of course, it's, I think, quite well known that very recently, China has outstripped the United States and Europe as the single largest trading partner for South Africa, also a member of the BRICS, also a government that is unwilling to comply completely with finance capital, even though it does have some elements of that. And South Africa is seeing something very similar happening, although the nature of the protests are distinctly different. Some of the forces that are involved in the protests in South Africa are very different, because you have a very active and very organized left that is also on the streets in South Africa, right, including the Economic Freedom Fighters led by Julius Malema, some of the elements of NUMSA, that's the National Union of Mine Workers, and Vavi and some of his faction. They're on the streets as well, but their impact is really forcing ANC, the African National Congress, and its allies in the Communist Party basically to move further to the left. But the West, the United States and Europe in particular, they're not particularly interested in seeing a socialist and communist style government and economic policy supplant the ANC in South Africa. What they want is their proxies in South Africa to come to power, and specifically that is the DA, the Democratic Alliance, and that's led by a guy named Maimane. And Maimane is known as, quote unquote, and I say this with all sincerity, quote unquote, South Africa's Obama. Okay, right. This is a young, up-and-coming political leader, the first leader, the first black leader of the Democratic Alliance, which is basically a center liberal, formerly all-white party in South Africa, which is very amenable to U.S. political and economic interests. And they have positioned themselves as anti-corruption crusaders in South Africa, who want to basically more or less lead a democratic, quote unquote, overthrow of the ANC and supplant it as the ruling party. This is really the nature of this soft coup that we're seeing in South Africa.
Yeah, the interesting thing about them using this corruption as a mask, aside from the utter absurdity of it when one considers the nature of the actual corruption, we saw that it's not ideological, and we saw that, or apparently ideological, that's the point. It's neutral in terms of ideology. If you're a crook, right. If you're a crook, you're a crook. It's just that all the crooks seem to be the people that we don't like, and all the people we do like are not crooks. You know,
yeah, isn't that interesting how that happens?
Yeah, so. You know, the phenomenon is going on, being played out in South Africa, also within the context of Mugabe nationalizing Zimbabwe, the diamond mines, and that as standing as an example to the people of South Africa, who urgently need to do exactly that. You have, let's say you're playing for the allegiance of these, of the native bourgeoisies in each case, and say in Brazil, for example, you know, so you're offering to the elite from the United States, basically, look, there's an intensive condition of inequality, economic inequality, wealth distribution inequality, that has been abated somewhat since 1998. So you guys can have back what you had. But of course, those people are pretty impoverished, so you're not going to grow much. And your political position is going to be somewhat untenable because you're going to need dictatorship to repress the impoverished masses. And, of course, we're not always a reliable partner. Just because we decided that we're doing business with you today doesn't mean we won't kick you out tomorrow in favor of somebody else. And China is offering instead, your entire economy will grow, you people will become world-class billionaires playing with China, and you'll have political stability.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I mean, does anybody need a better example of, specifically in South Africa, a better example of just how Western and U.S. focused and European focused the Democratic Alliance, the DA, is? Well, its leader, Maimane, has given multiple speeches at the famous or maybe infamous American Chamber of Commerce. And the Chamber of Commerce really should be understood as basically the principal organ of U.S. economic power projection in the global South. This is true all throughout Latin America. This is very much true in South Africa as well. And in his speech last year, Maimane says, before the assembled leadership of the Chamber of Commerce, he says, and I'm obviously paraphrasing here, basically, look, China has surpassed the United States as the leading trading partner of South Africa. But for us, the Democratic Alliance, the United States is still the single most important force. In other words, the subtext here is put us in power and we'll replace China with the United States as the leading dominant economic power in South Africa. That is really the larger game that's being played here. It's not about corruption. It's not about any of these other things. It's about economic power and influence in a major, major global South economy. A obviously the S in BRICS, a very significant partner, perhaps the single most important economy in Africa. I think that's maybe debatable. I suppose Egypt might be up there as well.
Nigeria.
But regardless of that, South Africa is critical, and the protests I think are very important. Now I should say here, and I just want to be very clear, I've been quite critical of the African National Congress, the ANC, along with its partners in the South African Communist Party, as well as COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions. I've been very critical of them. They've gotten deeply in bed with neoliberal finance capital. They've presided over a continued economic disenfranchisement of a large portion of the country. So there are major problems, both political and economic, with the ANC. However, and I've written about that and I've said that quite publicly. That being said, though, I know a destabilization when I see one, and this one is pretty obvious to me. And the reason, of course, is not because the ANC has done business with neoliberal finance capital. The reason is because the ANC is doing much more business with China, and that is really what this comes down to. This is about power. This is about control, and ultimately, this is about hegemony.
Yeah. And, you know, I have even been, and many others, quite, you know, correctly, I think, very critical of the deal that was struck by Mandela at the outset to end apartheid, which was quite different from the deal that was accomplished by Mugabe in Zimbabwe. And that is that the economy was left in the hands of the Europeans who came in and stole the country in the first place. They were never displaced as from their economic position, and the wealth was never redistributed. And that's something that still is in the minds of the people there, of course, because they're still suffering from it. And I think that there is a large sector of the population that is not going to say it's because these people are corrupt, but it's because of the nature of the economy. Or even these people are corrupt because they left the economy to the same nature it had before, but we got to get rid of them and this economy. And the Chinese don't look like the Europeans. As much as there's been the attempt to excite racism against people from Asia in South Africa, I don't know that that's going to sell quite as easily as a natural antipathy towards Europeans.
Well, I don't know if I on that last point, I'm not sure I agree necessarily, because I do think that for significant portions, look, I don't want to speak for South African people in general. It's not my place to do. But we do know the power of colonialized minds, colonial mentality, and sure. inferiority complexes. It's and there. This is it's unfortunately there, yeah. true all throughout the global South. We see it over and over and over again in the Middle East. We see it in sub-Saharan Africa, all over the place, that in many respects, oftentimes, especially the middle class in a lot of these countries, they desperately want to be, you know, patted on the head and given approval by white-skinned Europeans.
Even here, so, that's true in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That has been quite evident with the support for Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party machine by a large segments of the black misleadership class, as Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report.
Just go there. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, that, so I don't know that there is necessarily this antipathy towards Europeans and Americans, but there is definitely this very absurd sort of push basically against what has been called the cultural invasion by China. For instance, the African National Congress, that's the ruling party, the government in South Africa, has moved to basically institute Mandarin as a foreign language at the primary and secondary school levels, so that these children who are being educated now will learn how to speak Chinese, and that will then, of course, propel South Africa into a broader non-Western economic sphere for the next generation. Sure. And there's been major pushback against this. And it's not simply because, you know, Mandarin, you know, what they say, because, oh, Mandarin is so hard, it's not something that's good. It's because they know that that is how China will be entrenched as a long-term economic partner in South Africa. That's why they push against that. That's why they want English and Afrikaans and, maybe even French and Dutch and some of these other languages to maintain their supremacy in the education system. So there's many aspects to all of this. And again, I just want to note, you know, the economic freedom fighters, the landless peasants movements, the shack dwellers movements, all of these groups that are also protesting against the ANC, that are also vocal against the government. This is not to say that they're part of, you know, this broader conspiracy to overthrow the ANC, but the movement within which they are operating is at the largest level working in the interests of the West. So there is this sort of contradiction, I think, that a lot of people, particularly on the left, have to be aware of, that at the same moment that we want to see, you know, the redistribution of land, the nationalization of the mines, the expulsion of the exploiting Western corporations, and all of these other things that the far left has been advocating and is still advocating, at the very same time, we have to keep in mind that those same forces in the West that we want to be in opposition to are helping to orchestrate and to drive a lot of this movement.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and when I said natural antipathy, obviously I wasn't speaking biologically, as if the concepts of race were biological. And also, I'm not discounting the fact that institutionally, I mean, still many of the structures, in any event, many of the personnel of the apartheid era still exist there. So you're going to be cultivating that kind of, cultural activity anyway. But there is, an institutional memory of, you know, a social memory of apartheid.
Yes.
And the face of apartheid is European and not Asian. So
yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
That's part one of the elements that's there ultimately that'll have some influence in one way or another. Okay, so we understand the nature of the assault on the BRICS countries that's being undertaken, I think, and unless you want to flesh that out more. And otherwise, that what are some of the things that are being done as a defense, and what are some things that you see that could be done as a defense or perhaps a counteroffensive?
Well, there's a number of things, and I just want to finish the point that you were bringing up. Of course, I think that a lot of people, including, you know, many of the, you know, most vocal opponents of imperialism and colonialism, you know, have talked about the betrayal by the ANC, by Nelson Mandela, the going back on the ANC charter, which had promised the redistribution of land and the expulsion of the corporations and, you know, nationalization of all the important industries and all of these things. You know, like John Pilger and many others have done a lot of work on that, talking about that betrayal. At the very same time, we should keep in mind that the same has been said of Chavez in Venezuela, that he didn't, you know, dispossess the bourgeoisie. He didn't nationalize all the industries. He didn't strip them of their wealth the way that he should have. And there's an argument to be made that had he done that, maybe Chavez would still be alive. Maybe the situation in Venezuela would be significantly better. I think hindsight, obviously, there's a lot to debate there.
Just on that point also, and in fact, in Argentina, the left sat on their hands during the election, a part of the left, and that was why the right-wing president Macri got elected.
Oh, exactly. The certain factions on the left said, you know, we don't support Fernandez. We don't support the bourgeois left government. And lo and behold, the far right wing neoliberal stooge Macri wins by 2%. So, you know, absolutely. It's not like in the United States where, you know, both sides are completely controlled by the same interests. There are clear and distinct differences all throughout Latin America, just as I think we're seeing in South Africa as well. And, you know, finally, it has to be said, though, that despite all of that, despite everything that negative that could be said about the ANC, a lot has been done and a lot has been achieved in a relatively short period of time. I mean, 20 years, you've seen under ANC rule, I guess a little more than 20 years now, under ANC rule, you've seen millions of houses been constructed, low-income, working-class houses, a lot of people who have benefited significantly, schools, access to education, access to, you know, clean drinking water, you know, food security, a lot of these things, including, of course, you know, Western consumer goods, shopping malls, you know, highways, a lot of, you know, very tangible indicators of progress, which have been, I think, more, let's say, better distributed than they were obviously before, under apartheid. Right. But that isn't obviously to ignore all of the glaring deficiencies that still exists. So this is what I'm saying, that it's a problematic contradiction where on the one hand, we want to criticize the ANC and criticize their corruption and their lack of leadership and their lack of, you know, their closeness to neoliberal capital. At the same time, we have to recognize that neoliberal capital is targeting them for destruction and for overthrow.
And not only that, one also has to consider, which I do, as I criticize what happened with Mandela and the abolition of apartheid, one has to consider the fact that this is in the post-Soviet period, that there was no alternative to diktat from Wall Street, Washington, wherever, and that only now the possibility is coming into, you know, into existence with the BRICS and the rise of China and all of that.
Well, and you've already mentioned it. Look at Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe refused to engage with neoliberal finance capital when there was no real alternative, and Zimbabwe has been brutally crushed by you know, by the West. I mean, the sanctions, the destruction of its economy, you know, all of these things, they're direct byproducts of the fact that Zimbabwe, far less than South Africa, was willing to play ball, that you know, Mugabe, although he tried for many years to work with the British, to work with the United States, ultimately decided to go his own way and to nationalize and to redistribute the land through forcible seizure of the former, you know, the best agricultural land formerly in the hands of white settlers and their descendants. And look at how Zimbabwe has been demonized. Look at how Zimbabwe and Mugabe is, quote unquote, the Hitler of Africa and all this other nonsense that right. they say about Mugabe. So I think South Africa has tried, to a large extent, the ANC has tried to walk a line between the extreme, call it extreme independence of a Mugabe in Zimbabwe and the extreme subservience that you see from a lot of other quarters in the global South.
So now you're seeing the alternative, at least possibility, that is in existence. And again, the types of projects that China, that we've discussed about China doing in Latin America, they also have those for South Africa and anyone else in Africa. In fact, they're building some things like that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not obviously purely altruistic. I mean, the Chinese want the mineral extraction. They want energy. They want raw materials, all of this stuff. I mean, they want that, of course, for their economy and so forth. But at the same time, as we mentioned, the win-win investment strategy is really the centerpiece of China's entire strategy in Africa and all throughout the world. And that's what's so appealing, because there are no conditionalities. There are, you know, as the IMF does with its loans, there are, you know, there isn't this cycle of debt and debt servitude and debt servicing that you see with the World Bank, with some of these other institutions. And that's really why I think a lot of these countries look at China not only as an alternative, but they really, I think, they thank China for presenting them with a different economic model, a different economic development path. And that's what the United States and its allies want to crush. That's why you see this major push against the BRICS.
Maybe we could describe that a little, because what we're talking about, you mentioned Venezuela. You see China, as it extracts raw materials, to put it bluntly or crudely, it also is sending back on those ships as they come back. Instead of them coming back empty, they come back, A, with infrastructure that gets constructed on the on the ground in the country, factories to assemble Chinese-made parts, and income, basically enough money for the economy that the people, even at the bottom, can afford to buy Chinese products, and many of which will be made in the country.
Yes, and let's not underestimate the significance of infrastructure development, rails and ports and roads and all of these other things that
water,
you know, again, I mean, let's not say that this is purely altruistic. I mean, China needs that infrastructure in order to do the business, the kind of business that it wants to do. At the same time, when China's business is done, that infrastructure stays. And that is part of what makes it so enticing, where look at the options. You're a country in Africa, you want to build, you want a highway built, or you want a port built. Either you go to the Western financial institutions, you take out these loans with all the conditionalities, with the massive interest and all of the rest of that, and then you pay that for the next 100 years if you're lucky. Or B, you invite the Chinese to come in, build it all for you, invest in the country, and then leave that infrastructure once they're done. I mean, it's pretty obvious which of those two is the better option. And again, there's a lot of people who call what China's doing, you know, a form of economic imperialism, which I totally reject. I think that the truth is that what China is offering, although it's along the lines of, you know, capitalist investment, what China is offering is a markedly and objectively better path to economic development. Let's just some quick examples, right? China has built factories that not only for processing raw materials, China has built factories for making for manufacturing consumer goods, right? Consumer goods that will be purchased inside of that country, purchased with money that has been injected into the economy by Chinese investment. So there is a burgeoning market that is developing in a lot of these countries that China is, to a large extent, one of the major engines of. And you see that in South Africa, you see that in Nigeria, you see that in a number of countries in Africa where China is heavily involved. Factories, but also schools, hospitals, many other aspects of critical infrastructure. When you see people in Africa who are talking to each other on Chinese-made mobile phones, you know, and speaking and chatting online on Chinese-made computers, I think that tells you a lot about what China's really doing.
You know, on a small scale, you've seen Venezuela play that role in Latin America. One example that I've discussed with Tony Solo before is the electrical grid, quote unquote, in Nicaragua was essentially a large chunk of it is individual generating stations that came from Venezuela to do a quick build out of an electric grid. You know, they have elements, units that are basically local generators that they've done. And so what they've done, though, is focus their investment into Nicaragua on building, you know, rolling out an infrastructure so that all these parts of that country that had no electricity before now have that, and from that you build your own infrastructure on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. And Venezuela has been doing that in a number of spheres. Venezuela is now manufacturing and selling its Venezuelan-designed and Venezuelan-manufactured tablets that they're using. Each student in Venezuelan universities has been given a free tablet made in Venezuela with Venezuelan know-how. You know, when I was there, I took a tour of the CNE, the National Electoral Council, and one of the things that they explained to us was this incredible voting system that they have established in Venezuela, computerized, you know, electronic voting machines and voting system, which was designed as a partnership between Venezuela and Trinidad, using Venezuelan and Trinidadian computer technicians, computer know-how and expertise to design what is almost universally considered to be the best voting system anywhere in the world. And of course, Petrocaribe is another example of Venezuela funding economic development all throughout Latin America and the Caribbean space using oil revenue. Of course, oil revenue is now a major problem as oil prices have collapsed. And again, this ties back into this larger thrust, this larger push against the global south using commodity price collapse in order to deprive them of the capital they need to continue development.
Right. When you're talking about Petrocaribe, for example, you have essentially Venezuela helping to subsidize development in its customers by charging them only, I think it's half. You pay half of the cash now for the oil, and the other half you pay over 20 years. However, as you invest money in your own infrastructure and in your own uplift of your own people, that gets credited against the repayment. So it's a subsidy for development.
Yeah, and I think a good example, or maybe a test case or a laboratory or whatever of all of this is Haiti, right? In Haiti, when Petrocaribe came around, Chavez went to Haiti and he was quite literally welcomed as a hero. Right. He was cheered in the streets, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out cheering Chavez because of the subsidizing of Haiti's economic development by Venezuelan oil money. Fast forward to 2010, 2011, 2012, and you have the Haiti, a devastated country that is now quite literally occupied by the United Nations under the auspices of Hillary and Bill Clinton, the Clinton Global Initiative, a totally impoverished and completely devastated country that has very little prospects of anything positive coming in the future. Venezuela wanted to help Haiti emerge out of decades of economic privation.
Centuries. And
I'm sorry?
Two centuries, actually.
Yeah, well, if we're going to go back to 1804, absolutely. I mean, two centuries of it. But even just in the recent past, you know, Haiti has been economically devastated and obviously occupied numerous times. And this is what we've seen play out now, where Haiti is not only under UN and US occupation, but it is the victim of everything from cholera epidemics to, you know, preventable diseases, diarrhea, and all these other things. Childhood malnutrition, childhood poverty, all of these things are now, you know, rampant in Haiti. And Venezuela and some of the other Latin American countries of ALBA and CELAC, they were trying to prevent that. But of course, circumstances have been that the United States has reasserted its control.
And finally, along that line, when the United States began its economic warfare against Russia yet again, issued the sanctions in the Ukrainian crisis back in 2014. China said, okay, you're going to try to isolate them economically. Okay, let's put together a $500 billion deal for over long term for the purchase of natural gas from Siberia. And that kind of put the kibosh on the ability of the United States to economically isolate Russia. Not to downplay what has happened, but it was a big boost. Similarly, they could do that with Venezuela, and there have been some deals that were done, but I'm wondering if they can't shore up Venezuela's oil revenues that have been used for local development.
Well, they are doing that. We're seeing a number of deals. Maduro was in Beijing not that long ago. Chinese representatives have been in Venezuela as well. So that is happening. But the situation in Venezuela is complicated, and there is major political upheaval. And I think to some degree, the Chinese oftentimes are, quite cautious when it comes to countries where you have major political upheaval, maybe possibly to its detriment, because Chinese economic engagement would be one of the forces that would help stabilize the political climate in a country like Venezuela. But I do think we're seeing some of that. But again, there are a number of factors that basically, I think, prevent China from fully funding, and Russia, of course, fully funding Venezuela, or funding Russia for that matter. I think number one is that China is looking at its own economic issues. China has seen a major economic downturn in its country. Not only GDP growth slowing, but because of a variety of factors, including the up and down stock market, including the potential real estate issues in China, I think that they are somewhat cautious of being overextended globally, and they have major investments, as I mentioned earlier, in a place like Nicaragua. I don't know to what extent China doesn't want to get financially too far leveraged in the global south. So I think China is trying to walk a fine line here, and Russia is, of course, as well. I think the reality is that Russia is hurting economically. I mean, if you talk to people who are in Russia now, even those in the intelligentsia, down to the working class and the poor, they'll tell you that the economy right now is very difficult. The times are tough. And I think that all of these countries in the BRICS are seeing a major pushback from the empire, whether it's an economic one, whether it's a political one, or a combination of the two. I think that this was to be expected. Now, the question is, and obviously that's the $1 million or perhaps the $100 billion question, is how are the BRICS countries going to respond to all of this? Is the BRICS going to fracture, to break apart under the weight of this economic power that is being projected from Washington and from Wall Street and from London? Or are these forces going to drive the BRICS closer together, force them into further partnerships and strengthening their alliance? I think to a large extent, that is the burning question of the next few years.
And I think that'll be the burning question that we'll open with next week. Eric Dreitzer, a pleasure talking with you about your upcoming series on the assault on the BRICS by the Western imperial construct.
And yeah, please do check it out. It'll be on Mint Press News, mintpressnews.com, I believe.
All right, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.